Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Dr. John Stamey and welcome to ScaryCast. We're so glad to have everybody here. We've got a great guest, we've got great co-hosts, and I think I'll start introducing everybody. First of all, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast, from the Midlands of South Carolina, the one and only Dr. Trey Dunaway, trying to keep me straight on all my weird questions. How are you doing tonight, Dr. Trey?
Oh, I'm doing great, John.
We're glad to
have
you.
I'm always happy to answer weird questions.
I know. You answer my phone calls. You always know it's going to be weird. But that's okay, and thanks a lot. I had a weird one earlier, and you were kind enough to answer it, so thanks a lot. Glad to have you here. And from, make sure I get this right now, from Sacramento, California. Did I get it right, Devin?
Yep.
From there's Sacramento, some, California, Devin Tate. How are you doing tonight, Devin?
I'm good. I apologize for the background noise. I am walking home through the lively River District, and our motto here is building, investing, and connecting. So you hear some of that building maybe going on in the background, but lots of stuff going on here, and it's all good.
Well, that's great. Well, we're glad to have you here, and glad you made it up from West Hollywood all the way to Sacramento. So that's great. And let's see. From Houston, Texas, Kyler Smith, how are you doing tonight, Kyler?
I'm doing awesome. I'm in a great mood.
Well, that's great. We're glad to have you here. And, of course, our guest from Nashville, Tennessee, brought to us by the Queen of ScaryCast, because she is a friend of both his and mine, the one and only Dave Eller from Nashville. How are you doing tonight, Dave?
I'm doing very good. Thanks for asking, and I just appreciate you having me on and allowing me to tell some of my tales.
Well, we're glad to have you on here. Yeah, you're a Bigfoot explorer and researcher, and you got at least one extremely engaging video on YouTube. I have enjoyed it actually twice, and so it's really good. So why don't you start out and tell us a little bit about what the heck it is you do for fun, because you're like a lot of us, you do your research for fun. So tell us about what you do and maybe what you found. It's very, very interesting.
Well, my journey started a long time ago. When I was about 8 years old, I read an article about the Patterson-Gimlin film in an issue of Reader's Digest. And from that point on, it became kind of a fever. I wanted to know what these things were and where they were and how they functioned. And so gradually as I grew up, got out on my own, I was able to start traveling, and I began to do my own research, and I've been doing that for over 30 years. And I travel across the U.S. I've been to various foreign countries looking for the strange and unexplained. And recently, it was the first part of last year, one of my friends who lives next to a state park here in Tennessee would text me pictures of his morning walks and say this, and he would say, this is where I walk and this is what I see. And as he would send me these pictures, I would look at him, and the woods that he was walking through just kind of impressed me. And I sent back one time, that looks really squatchy. And he sent me back that to his knowledge, no one had ever reported Bigfoot activity in the area, but he was sure that the park would love for me to come out and talk about it, do a program. So I said, okay, let me just come out. So I went through the entire main part of the park and never really discovered much of anything. And I was all over that area, back off into the trails and into the wetter areas and just all over. And was kind of disappointed that I couldn't find anything, because the pictures he was showing me were telling me something else. As I was leaving the park, I found a map, and I looked on it, and there was one area way off to the side that was not really advertised, and it was called a natural area. And it was far enough away from the main part of the park, I thought, well, that could very well be where I need to go. So the next day I went, and I was only in there probably 15 minutes before I found the first of what I call the ghost. And this was a structure. And before I got too excited about it, I got up on it and I began to look at it. Now, this structure was created from 20 trees that were bent to the center, and the limbs and branches, even down to the smallest twig, had been braided together so that the trees don't spring back up to their original position. So for all intent and purpose, this thing looks like a garden pagoda or an igloo or something like that. So I began to look all over it. Of course, the first thing I thought was maybe it was a Boy Scout project or a drunken college stunt or whatever. And I began to look at this thing, and there was no string, no wire, no twist ties, no nothing. It was created with strength and manual dexterity. And when I say these limbs are braided, they are truly braided. They're not just twisted together. There are no vines on this at all. I have had a couple researchers say that this was vine work, and I say, no, you're wrong. There are no vines anywhere near this structure, much less on it. And you can see the force that had to be used to pull some of these branches back and forth. So before I went any further, I called my friend who sent me the pictures. And he is a museologist. He has created 7 museums throughout his lifetime. So he knows what to look for and, what to scan, what to look at. So I didn't mention the word braid. And he came out. He began to look. I didn't tell him anything. I just let him decide what he was seeing. So he looked at it and was real quiet and kept looking. And then he stepped back and said, "This is braided." And I said, "Thank you." I didn't say that word. I consciously kept from saying that word so I wouldn't color your words. And he said, "No, this is braided." So I called a ranger out, and she looked at it and couldn't figure it out at all. She said, "No, this is not natural. This does not occur in nature. I don't know who or what made this. We didn't even know this was here. But this is not natural." And, of course, she's trained in forest dynamics. So I put my trust in what she said. Well, out in front of this pagoda, this first one, I found 2 what I have come to call markers. And actually there was 1 that was made of stone that had been set between 2 saplings. The saplings were twisted and braided at the top to keep the rock from falling out. And I have since started calling these axes because that's what they look like. It looks like you had set an axe down on the ground with head down. Next to it, it was a V-stack where multiple limbs, all the same size, had been stacked between 2 saplings. Next to that was what I call a failed marker, and it was like the first, but somewhere along the line, the stone has been pulled out and left to the side. So why that marker was changed, I don't know. On down the trail, after about 3 weeks of me, and I began to go once a week throughout the year. So that's how this journey started. So once a week, I would go and investigate this site. Well, I moved on down the trail, and I began to know everything that's on this trail. And if anything new popped up, I was going to see it. Well, one day, a brand new pagoda popped up. And this was about 4 days after I had been down that trail, and there was nothing there. So I believe that these creatures, and I think there's at least 3 of them that frequent this, and I will tell you why later. But these creatures made this new pagoda simply because I began to show so much interest in the first. And there was no marker on this one, and I couldn't figure it out because I had already decided that these markers must be a part of these pagodas. And this first one that I found was 7 foot tall in the center. The second one that I found was fairly the same size. It was about 25 trees that had been pulled to the center and domed over, but it was about 7.5 feet tall in the center. Later on, weeks and weeks later, I was in another part of the forest, and I found a larger one. So now there are three that I have found, the largest one being 30 by 20. And it's almost as though they were making two together, because you can kind of see two domes that are connected. At this pagoda, there are five different markers. Two, like the axes that I found at the first one, there were two stones in larger trees, and then a third smaller tree that had the stone with it. Since then, they have made another tiny little arch out of two very small saplings, and the last time I was there, they had made like a loop top on one of the small saplings. So it's like a circular top to a sapling, where they have just pulled it around and made kind of a wreath and braided it all back together. So these markers are very much part of these pagodas. And only recently, because it confused me so badly that there was no marker at the second pagoda, I was walking by it and they had created another marker, just like the first one that I found at the first pagoda, the stone sitting in between two small saplings. So it completely verifies my theory that these markers have something to do. They're very much tied in with these pagodas. Now, what does that mean? Is this a way that they sign their work? Or are these markers a way for other creatures to show their appreciation? Or are these directional markers? Because these markers almost always face toward the center of the pagoda that they're associated with. So there's some kind of language here, a physical language. And they're saying something, and of course I don't know what they're saying. I'm just sitting back trying to figure out what they're doing. But there is a definite connection between markers and pagodas.
Okay. This is John, and I wanted to say something. We at the fourth Tennessee Bigfoot Conference that was held at Bays Mountain Park in Kingsport, Tennessee, we got there on Thursday, and on Friday morning, the conference started. And unbeknownst to us, one of the guys who was speaking at the conference, he fell from Tennessee, I believe. He came in, he said, "John, you need to come see this." I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, just come see what I've found." And there are pictures of this on the Facebook page for Tennessee Bigfoot Conference. There are these amazing stick structures that were built. And I went around and I asked the park staff, I said, "Have you seen these? I mean, do you know what these are?" And every member of the park staff said, well, those weren't here just a couple of days ago. I mean, what is this?" And everybody was fairly amazed. Now, Robin McCray is with us. Robin, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I was trying to say hi to everybody, but you guys couldn't hear me.
Well, we're glad you're here. Now, Robin, you do remember at the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference when we found all those stick structures right next to the Farmstead Museum, don't you?
Yeah, and if you remember that same day, I believe it was William that was up speaking, and I was at the back, and I walked over to the window, and if you remember, it's like a two-story building. And when I looked out the window, Janice Carter was with me, and there was a black male Bigfoot that ran down that hill going towards where all those structures were. But somebody, I can't remember who it was, asked somebody that worked there, and they said those structures were not there a few days before. They just appeared.
That was actually me, because I went and I found the maintenance crew, and I went around and talked to them, and they said they weren't there. And then all of a sudden, they were a bit amazed that they were there then. And we've got pictures of those all over our Facebook page for Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, which will be in Paris, Tennessee on October 1st. And Dave Eller will be there, and some more folks from up in that area are going to be there. We're going to have a lot of fun.
Mark Holt's coming too, isn't he?
Who?
Mark Holt. Mark Holt's supposed to be there too.
Yeah, we had talked with him, and I'm glad he's going to be able to make it there. So, yeah, that's going to be great. So, Well, that's good. So I'll tell you what, we've got these Bigfoot structures are very interesting and they're very real. They're not, you know, I mean, when you're talking about a pagoda, you're talking about a woven structure that is a little bit like a canopy. Would that be the best way to describe it, Dave?
Yeah, kind of. But it's just, I mean, yeah, just imagine, it's almost like a spider web. Once you look at the top, you begin to see this spider web kind of look to everything. And it's very complicated. And I, as an artist, I look at these things and I see the artistry in them. They're not a place that something could go and stay out of the weather. They're a beautiful, delicate kind of a thing. So I don't believe they're designed as any sort of domicile. Again, you know, they would stand up in any modern art gallery. It's almost like these creatures are interpreting their surroundings by using their surroundings. Now, maybe these things might be where they put their young while the adults go foraging, you know, like gorillas. Gorillas will do that kind of thing. But who knows? I don't know. Is there a reverence attached to these? Is this where something special happens? Again, I don't know. And I don't know anyone who can tell me. I mean, at this point, we know nothing and won't know anything until we get one or more of these creatures in a situation where we can monitor them 24/7. But even then, we would get nothing but forced behavior. They would do what they feel comfortable in showing us, just like gorillas. And I keep going back to gorillas because I research these things as though they're flesh and blood creatures that are subject to every physical law as we are. So I'm researching them as animals. And like a gorilla will fling poop in the zoo. Well, they don't do that in the natural world. That's a forced behavior created by being captive. So if you put some of these creatures that I feel are super intelligent into a situation where they can't get out when they want to, that can make you crazy. Just like you see weird behavior by gorillas and orangutans because they're mentally having problems. So how could we make a cage or a situation where a crazy Bigfoot is trying to get out? Can we make something strong enough to keep a Bigfoot from escaping? I don't know, but that could be one of the possibilities of putting something like that in captivity. So once again, where do we go with this stuff? But the structures
I would say that those are interesting comments. So far, to the best of our knowledge, and Robin, you know, you can weigh in on this, we have not necessarily captured a Bigfoot and put it on display like you're talking about with those gorillas. Is that, Robin, as far as you know, is that a correct statement?
No. The government has captured a multitude of them, and they're kept where we can't even get to them. As far as putting them on display, that wouldn't work anyway. They're going to cloak and you're not going to see much. But as far as to find something that's strong enough to hold them, it would be very, very difficult. And the only thing I do know about the holding facilities where they are held in is there's a lot of ways, whether it's they're drugged, whether it's the one contact I had said they have these energy weapons that can drain their energy so that they're weakened. There's a lot that goes into it. It's not something where you can get one, which you wouldn't anyway. They're a human hybrid. You don't capture people and put them on display. You're not going to do that with them. But it would be very, very difficult to do it. And as far as the structures, you know, Dave's right. Dave, it's nice to see you or talk to you again, by the way. I didn't get to spend much time talking to you when we were in Nebraska, so it's good to have you on the show tonight.
Yeah, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, you and your wife were delightful. You really were. I'm sorry I didn't have more time to talk to you. But it is a form of communication. There's a basis line that goes across the board between clans that means certain things, and then each clan will also individualize it so only the members of their clan know what it means. Now your arches, your teepees, the teepees you find are not permanent homes. Those are a temporary shelter. Those are ones walking through and leaning sticks up to mark how many have gone through there. But the ones that are an actual teepee, they do that. Just they can sit there and hide waiting for prey. They can put the children in them. They can, if they're out, one of the ones that are out scouting and hunting for the rest of the clan, they might camp out overnight in it. It's not their actual home. It's just a temporary type shelter, just like if you went out camping and you stayed in the tent overnight. But all these structures have a meaning. And
yeah, no doubt.
Like I said, there's
no doubt. I mean,
yeah,
they're beautiful,
and the
beautiful
dogging,
structures.
Oh, they're just exquisite. I have over 14,000 photos of nothing but structures. And I have these photo frames that you put the SD card in and then it just keeps rotating the photos. And
yeah.
For years, I've had those on my wall. And I was like, you know, when your kids do drawings at school, you know, you have them on the fridge or whatever. For a long time, my entire house was nothing but structures. And when I lived in Michigan, one of the places – I've watched and studied structures since I was four. And when I was at this one place I lived at in Michigan, the Bigfoot walked around freely. Sometimes they would cloak. Most of the time they weren't cloaked, and they just walked around the yard all the time. And I went out every night with them. And – when they found out I enjoyed these structures, I would go out there and you guys, I love them. They're fantastic. The next day, the entire woods was encompassed with them. And Igor Borstov came out and he went in the front part of the woods. And he was out there for like 4 or 5 hours. And I'm like, my gosh, you know, something happened to him. Finally, he came in and I said, well, did you see this one that I call the boat? And did you see this one and this one? And he's like, and there's only 2.5 acres in the front. And he's like, I never got through it all. He said, I've never seen anything like it. I said, well, this is normal, right? He said, there's nothing about this that's normal. Nowhere do they have this many. They were on top of each other. You literally could not turn around. And they had an area where the kids would play that they had fenced out. But the bottom line is that they all have a meaning. You know, you have your upright X's, which mean keep out. If you have an upright X and you have a post on each side of it, that's a territory marker and a keep out. And they are not playing games at that point. If you have an X on the ground, that means welcome. You know, the other thing too, and Dave, you can do this when you go out. When you see the pagodas or the arches or anything, if you take your hand to the highest point of it inside within the structure, not all of them, but some of them, you will feel an energy flux. And we've actually taken the little meters to check that theory out, and it works every time. Not all will have it, but a lot of them will. And we actually had a friend of mine, I was explaining it to him, this was several years ago, and he said, well, can I videotape you while you're explaining it so I can look at it later and kind of go over what you're teaching me? And I said, yeah, I guess it's fine. We actually got something running out. It was the energy flux in there opened up to a portal, and he got something on film zipping out of that. And it was a little structure. It was only like 3 foot tall, but it was a little arch. And it was
The arches are really amazing. I just love being in them, and I just love being in those pagodas. And the stick structures that you were talking about earlier, this place is covered in those. And, you know, I have all the classics like seesaws, you know, logs put in the crotches of trees and balanced perfectly, markers that are pointing in certain directions, the giant X's. And then we get into
upright it means stay out. And most of that staying out is not necessarily directed at you, although you need to exercise caution with it and respect it. But most of it is actually for other clans and other people coming through. Now, they will put the upright X's with the posts on either side to mark their territory, and then they don't want anybody there. That is their area. And that could be where they let the kids come or whatever, because the last thing you want to do is be anywhere where the kids are.
How is this little structure, how is this how is this a home, or how is this a temporary home? It just looks like a little...
The little teepees?
Yeah.
All they do in those is they'll go in and they'll sit there, or if they've left where they have their actual homes at, and I've only been to them once. I know of two areas that they have them, but they took me to one. And you're talking about areas that you can't get in. They're like unpenetrable. It's unbelievable. It's like nothing you'll ever see in your life. And these little tiny teepees that you find out in the woods, what they do is they'll have, you know, there's different jobs within the clan. The ones that are out hunting, they may be out hunting and they slept there overnight. It's a temporary thing. You find a lot of them near the parks, just like when we had the Tennessee Bigfoot, and they'll sit in them and they'll watch people. They'll people watch. But those are not their actual homes. Those are not, you know, where they go and hang their little hairy feet at the end of the day. Those are a temporary thing that they can use it as a blind to hunt. They can use it as a place just to sit, you know, because they're out hunting, and when they're done, they're going to go back home or whatever. I have another friend that has them in an area he goes to, and he's gone in there and he's found, you know, different remnants where they've had something to eat or whatever, and a lot of footprints inside of them. But those are temporary shelters. Those are not their actual homes, and people get really confused by that, but they're not. And but like I said, you can go in any of these, and it's not in every single one, so I don't want anybody to think that, you know, if they don't feel it, then I'm making it up. I'm not making it up. But, and we've taken the equipment in to test this out. Some of these structures, when you put your hand at the highest point inside the structure, you can literally feel an energy flux there. It's really bizarre. I know people that have gone in there and taken a light bulb, and some that are really strong and the light bulb kicks on. You know, I've not done the light bulb thing, but I've taken the equipment in there.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I've taken a lot of electrical equipment. I've taken a lot of electrical equipment into the field and had some really interesting things happen. But I get all sorts of screams and yells and hums. I've heard things I've never heard before. I mean, like I say, I've been doing this 30 years, and this one spot produces so many vocalizations and sounds. They imitate woodpeckers. And when I first heard these woodpecker sounds, I thought, that's the weirdest woodpecker. That doesn't sound like a woodpecker. And then one day I was walking along, and I just happened to see, I was doing wood knocks, and I just happened to see two trees standing together. And I had my mallet, and I just began to move back and forth real quick between them. And it made that woodpecker sound. And I said, that's what I have been hearing. Well, then they started answering me. And I thought to myself, well, woodpeckers don't communicate with pecks. They've got a very unique vocalization. So something is answering that's not a woodpecker. And then before it was done, I was talking to two different creatures with a woodpecker sound and a third one that was doing the classic wood knock. So for 5 to 10 minutes, I was carrying on a conversation with three of these creatures. And if you look at these pagodas, you kind of look at them like it has to take at least three of them to make these. One to pull this tree down, another one to pull this tree down, and then a third to start doing the braids, because there's no way that a single creature could be doing these. And then you start getting into the screams, and I do a lot of research at night with no light. I try to keep my lights off as much as possible. So these things will scream at night, and no one has ever heard a Bigfoot scream. It sounds like a woman being murdered.
Yeah.
It's just the most blood-curdling sound. The first time I heard it, I actually thought, why is there a woman screaming at me in the woods? And I had already passed this thing, so it didn't need to let me know it was there. I had already missed it. Well, it screamed at me kind of like, hey, here I am. And I thought I was going to die. And I whip around, and I see the big, huge form. No details, no heads or arms or anything like that. It was just the big hulking form, but you could tell it was hairy. And it paralleled my path and then made a 90-degree turn to the left and began popping trees as it went, wood knocking, pow, 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 until I couldn't hear it anymore. And I thought, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. So I saw the trajectory that this thing was going, and I thought, I am going to catch that thing over on the other trail. So I go down the trail, make a left, and I get to where I think this thing may be coming. Now, this takes you into the more paranormal stuff. And like I say, I research these creatures as flesh and blood, but it doesn't take long of investigating Bigfoot before you start coming up on these paranormal things. So here I am,
exactly,
going down this trail. off in front of me, I hear one of the screams, the woman being murdered. This deer comes running out at me, and its eyes are the huge, like, what do I do now? And this thing was screaming back behind it. And so we're standing face to face hearing this thing, and you can tell that deer wants to get out. Well, right then, to my right, another one screams. And it's like within 25 or 30 feet of me, there's nothing there. There is nothing there, and I'm hearing this thing screaming, and I'm looking at where the sound's coming from, and there's nothing there. The deer bolts to my left, and you hear the one in the back screaming, and I'm standing there, and the one to my right is screaming, and again, there is nothing there. And I think what happened is, if you're into the whole cloaking thing, I think that these guys were hunting this deer. And I got in the way, and that the one was cloaked, hiding from the deer that the other one was bringing toward it. That's the only thing I can figure out. I've also been in areas where I'm so close I can hear this thing breathing, and it sounds like Darth Vader. It's like a...
Oh, they'll walk right up behind you. They will cloak and walk right up behind you and breathe in your ear.
Well, see, that takes you into the Native American theories on these things. The Native Americans always said that these creatures move between realities, and they can walk right in front of you, and you will never see them. And I've had so many adventures in this 150 acres that I had to write a book about it. So hopefully my book will be coming out in the next few months. I've been told that there's a paper shortage, that paper companies are making more money now making boxes than they are making paper for books. That just seems weird to me, but that's the story. So, but yeah, just amazing stuff. One of them hummed at me one time, and it's a very soft, like they were opening, they were humming and opening their mouth up and down while they hummed, and it was kind of like a my, my, my kind of a sound. One of them.
Yeah, and they'll chant. They'll do a chant.
One of them was kind of tracking me, trailing me, because I've been watched from the very first time I ever stepped foot into that forest. And they will track me and trace me and follow me. And I hid, and it lost me. And it began to kind of sing, kind of make me pop my head up. And it was when I say singing, it's not like human singing, but it was just kind of a, like you say, a chant, just a soft kind of a thing. And they will whistle, but the whistles, I was talking to Ron Moorhead a few months ago, and we were talking about the whistling, and whistles are actually made in the throat rather than by the lips. And the best way to describe it is it's a Mariah Carey high note that sounds like a whistle.
And instead of breathing out, they breathe in. That's how they get it. They don't blow out like we do. They suck the air in.
And it's like every young boy, when they hear their friends do that whistle that guys do, they blow their air over the bottom lip through their teeth. And I can't do it, but that's, you always try to learn to do that. And if you can't do it when you're young and the testosterone hasn't hit yet and your voice is really high, you can do that Mariah Carey high note. And that's the way most young boys do that when they're learning how to do that whistle. And that's what these creatures are doing. It's that Mariah Carey thing. And if they had punked me, there was one time when I was coming, there's these things called glades, and they are, the floor of the forest is covered in these rocks. And when you walk across them, they make a very distinct sound when they clack together. Well, I was coming from the glade toward the first pagoda. I got all the way to the first pagoda, and I began to hear clack, 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 rock on rock. You could tell that something with hands was smacking these things together. Well, I thought, well, I was just there, and there was nothing there, so I head back to the glade. Just before I get there to a point where I can see what's going on, it stops. I walk into the glade. I look around. There's nothing there. So I head back to the pagoda. Just about the time I get to the pagoda, clack, 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 and I'm thinking, there that is again. I got to go see what it is. So I went back the second time. Nothing there. I went back to the pagoda the third time. Again, clack, clack, clack. So they did this five times before I realized they're punking me. This is humor. These creatures want to see how many times I will go back and check it out. And it's like, that's human. That's a human trait, this punking kind of a thing. I don't know of any animals that punk. So these creatures are
they have a weird sense of humor.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And I do call blasting and have gotten some amazing stuff by using, there was these recordings done in a Japanese zoo, gibbons. These gibbons were screaming, and I used that, and I was pumping this into the forest, and when I got done, they began to scream. So it's like whatever those gibbons were saying was exciting the Bigfoot creatures. And, you know, sound, I think, is truly important to these creatures because they have so many vocalizations and variations of wood knocking. You know, when you first get into this, you think, you know, just the standard wood knock, pow, kind of thing. But you soon learn that there's many variations of that, from the woodpecker sound to an almost kind of a Morse code kind of thing. And I've often wondered if that Morse code really is a Morse code kind of thing. Is that a wood knock language beyond just the simple pow that lets everybody know there's an intruder in the woods? But it's almost like a wood knock language. And I began to do that, just doing that kind of thing, and I would always get reaction. So, I mean, it's an amazing area. I mean, it's so crazy that people have begun calling it the Holy Grail of Bigfoot sites because of everything that's going on, and I just think that's great, you know. And film that you guys have seen, the film was taken by a very well-known cinematographer named Mark Pleasant, who worked on the Remington documentary. He's very well known in film, and he just really turned on to my adventures, and so he's gradually doing a full documentary about this site.
Okay, well, that's really cool, and I mean, definitely. And now I want to ask some of our co-hosts who haven't had a chance to speak yet. Dr. Trey, do you have any questions for Dave? This is just fascinating.
But what I particularly like is sometimes we see people who've had a Bigfoot sighting, and it's like, I saw this thing that I think is a Bigfoot, and then it went away. And that's it. There's nothing to examine. It's all based on one person's interpretation of something they saw, whether it was a Bigfoot or whether it was something else, and that's it. But, Dave, what's different about this, of course, is that you have physical evidence. And having trees braided at 7.5 feet above ground level, my fraternity brothers, even when they were drunk, couldn't do that. And
right.
I don't think Boy Scouts could do that either. And that would be the first thing I'd think, just like you did when you saw it. But here's the question. Were you able to kind of do a forensic analysis of the ground? Could you see ladder marks where somebody could have had a ladder and that would have left impressions like a ladder, where they would get things together? Did you find the footprints? It sounds like
no.
There have been recordings of footprints, but was there any forensic evidence? If you were investigating a crime scene, did you turn up anything other than the structure itself?
Yes. Okay, the first part of your question, I looked all over. I looked over. My friend, the museologist, looked everywhere. The ranger looked everywhere. There is no evidence of how these things were created. No ladder marks, no remnants of ropes. I mean, like I say, I mean, it would take, I'm thinking, at least three individual creatures, whether that's human or Bigfoot, to do these things.
Right.
And there's no evidence of any kind of assistance with ladders or chairs or anything like that. Now, what I did find, and this is one of the most fascinating aspects of this entire investigation, on the floor of the first pagoda. Now remember, we're in the forest, and there's lots of forest litter. there's lots of leaves. There's lots of stuff that's going to keep footprints from being made. On the floor of this first pagoda, I began to find sticks, all the same size, all lined up in rows, all piled in certain areas. And there's probably 5 or 6 or 7 areas where this has happened. All the same size, all the same length, all the same thickness, as though something or someone has either made them this size or gathered specifically this size of stick and lined them all up. Well, this confused me. I began to think, are humans coming in here and piling up firewood or something? What is happening? Well, in my research, I came across a guy named Christopher Knowles. Now, since I first met him, I have come to love this guy. And he has some theories, and I got his book about Bigfoot structures. And everything I'm finding in this 150-acre area is in this book. All of the small trees that are bent over and then weighted at the end to keep them from popping back, everything. So he's got this, the savant theory. It's the Bigfoot brain, autistic brain theory. And he shows you in a video how autistic people will line everything up. They will stack it in a certain way. They'll line stuff up. Autistic people's rooms are always immaculately structured and organized. And he said, this is what they do. There's something in the Bigfoot brain that's akin to autistic brain. And they will do this. They will take these sticks and everything and create them at the right size and begin to stack them, line them up. And that, then I went back to the structure, and I'm seeing everything that he's saying, that it is an organization kind of a thing. Now, whether the children come in and play with these sticks, I don't know. When they get done playing, are they supposed to line everything back up? But the floor of this structure, this first structure, is covered in this kind of activity. And it was one of the first inklings that I had that I was dealing with something beyond just an animal. Gorillas mm-hmm. don't do this. Chimps don't do this. They may gather a couple sticks, but they're never the same size. They're not the same. This is, and I'm talking like 12, 15 to 20 sticks, all the same size, just lined up in rows. And, of course, the forest has kind of taken some of this over. There's grass growing between them, or there's leaves covering them. But you can see the organizational aspect on the floor of these pagodas.
Have you seen any evidence of fur or, you know, it would be interesting, and I don't know if this is possible, but, you know, you watch CSI, anything's possible. DNA samples of something that recently popped up that maybe hasn't been rained away or any opportunity for that type of investigation?
Yeah, there is the environmental DNA that you can use, you know, dirt samples from inside the pagoda, things like that. The problem with that is it's so expensive. I've already contacted some DNA places, and it's way more than I can afford to do this kind of thing. Of course, I've gathered samples, and I've got them, but I haven't done anything with them because, you know, the cost is just way beyond what I can deal with. But
right.
I have looked on some of the arches. I've never found any fur or anything like that. This is another weird aspect of this. I did see what I believe to be a young one on the backside of the first pagoda. Now, if you believe that these things do have family units or clans or tribes or whatever, obviously there have to be young ones. And the ones that have been sighted tend to be a reddish fur or hair. And this thing popped up next to me. I was on the backside of this first pagoda. This thing popped up next to me. It was hidden in the brushy, not a kudzu kind of stuff, but there are bushy plants that are in this area. Well, it was down in that. Now, of course, the first thing I thought, without really letting it sink into my brain, I thought it was a fawn, even though it was bigger than a fawn and didn't have the shape of a fawn. I'm trying to make it into a fawn. The coloration of it was the color of a fox. So suddenly I switch over trying to make it a fox. Well, this thing was way too big. This thing looked like a small pig, but I never saw its legs underneath it. So it may very well have been running on all fours, as some of these creatures are said to do at certain times. It was furry. It was larger than any animal I was trying to make it out to be, and its head was facing toward the ground. It did have a small tuft of hair on the top of its head that looked like a nose at first glance. Well, it wasn't the nose, it was the top of the head, and because of the way it was running on all fours, it looked like that was the nose. It never did get up off all fours, and I could never see its legs, how the legs were connected to the body. So, you know, it didn't run like a dog. It didn't run like a deer. It didn't run like anything except a kid running on all fours, acting like an animal. This thing was probably, what the parts I saw of it was probably 3 feet long and was probably 2 feet wide. And again, you know, when I first saw it, I was trying to make it out to be something that it wasn't. And I didn't even tell the story for a long, long time. I didn't even tell my wife until just about a month ago. And I've thought about this all this time, and I'm thinking, was that a baby Bigfoot? You know, I was holding in my head thinking, what did I see? I can't tell anybody I saw that because they're going to think I'm crazy and trying to make this area more dramatic than what it is. But it's the only thing I can figure is that this was a baby Bigfoot and it was running on all fours trying to keep as low as possible. And it's like this first pagoda seems to be a very special place. According to the ranger, the vertical growth off of these arches, and there's a name for that, and I can't think of it, but the vertical growth, she said, looks to be that this pagoda is 3 to 5 years old. So it's been there a while. It's starting to show some age, and the forest is taking part of it back. So my thing was, I don't ever want to destroy this thing, but if nature is destroying it on its own, then I feel like I have to take some of the braids. Once a braid falls to the ground, I figure I might as well take it or nature will destroy it. So I do have a few examples of these braids that I plan to put in a Bigfoot museum that I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
So
Everyone
will be able to see some of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Devin, do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make?
Oh, I find this really interesting. And, you know, now that I moved to a little more less urban environment, you know, I'm right by a river and lots of trees and stuff around. So I'm excited to kind of go out and hunt around here and see what I might be able to find too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They frequent rivers. They follow rivers and creeks. More times than not, the sighting is going to be around running water than still water, like a pond. But they also frequent ponds. But if you're by a river, man, just go out and whoop. Just do a whoop and see what you get.
Yeah, I'm about a mile or less down from the confluence of the American River and the Sacramento River. So there's a lot of water around here.
Yeah, that's cool.
Devin, that's so funny that you talk about the confluence. There's a joke, but it's true. Down in Charleston, in the Charleston Museum, the early settlers of Charleston made the following statement, that the Atlantic Ocean was formed at the confluence of the Cooper and Ashley Rivers. And I mean, you know, they felt the Ashley and the Cooper Rivers formed the Atlantic Ocean. I think that's great. You just reminded me
that. That's absolutely true. I mean, everybody knows that. I mean, who doesn't
know
that? I mean, we've had people on this show that will claim that the Earth is flat, and if they can claim that, then I can certainly, I know. The Ashley and the Cooper River joined together at the Charleston Peninsula to create the Atlantic Ocean. It's a well-known fact in South Carolina.
Well, thank you, Trey. Well, it's in the Charleston Museum, and you can go see it. I had a friend down there from Canada, and we were walking around, and I saw it, and I was stunned. I couldn't stop laughing for 5 minutes. I thought that was the greatest
thing. My favorite thing in the Charleston Museum was in the old Charleston Museum before it burned. But the old Charleston Museum, Milby Burton was the director, and you walked in, and right in the front lobby, there was this covered container, and it had kind of a heavy hardware wire cover of an opening that you could look into, and it says, "Look at the litter bug." And so when you looked in, there was a mirror. So the litter bug was a reflection of the person looking in. Charleston Museum has lots of accurate stuff. I'd never seen a litter bug before that was in captivity, and there it was.
That's great. Well, Dave, I tell you what, you have certainly spawned some great conversations. This is wonderful. And now, when do you think your book is going to be out? This is the first thing I want to say. When is the book coming out?
Well, the publisher said 4 to 5 months about a month ago. So whatever that is, okay, is what, June, August, September, October, November. Well, it's going to be December at least. So
December of 2022 or 2023.
Yeah.
So you always have to make sure you get the year right, not the month.
Right, exactly. And then I'm also working on another book that relates tales other than those dealing with the pagoda site, things that I have investigated, like, do we have time to tell a story?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. A few years ago, I heard on television that there was this town in Kentucky where this incident occurred, and the sheriff of that town said he thinks it was a Bigfoot incident. I had created this organization called Pursue, the Paranormal Unit for the Research and Study of Unexplained Events, and what I do is I go out and I investigate these things. So I knew that I had to investigate this. Well, I heard this story on a Sunday night. The following Saturday, I was in that town looking at the site. Well, now, the story revolved around three dead horses. So I get to the site, and I talk to a young man, and he said, yeah, the guy who owns the horses lives right over there. So I go knock on his door, and he immediately wants to talk to me. And he said, I can't get anybody to talk to me about this. So we went out behind his house. Now, there was a pond behind his house, and from the corner of his house to the pond, you could easily throw a baseball and hit the pond. So it was pretty close. Around this pond, there were three horses, okay? The fence bisected the pond. So the fence ran through the pond, so the horses couldn't get over to the other side of the pond. Well, he said he comes out. There was no sound involved here. He said there were no screaming horses. There was no commotion. He came out and found his three horses dead. One of them, he said, looks to have been thrown across the fence into the other end of the pond. He said, there's no way that this horse could have gotten over there unless it was thrown. So I said, were there tracks? He said, there were absolutely no tracks, no cat tracks, no dog tracks, no Bigfoot tracks, nothing. So he showed me where the horses were found dead. He said, there were no claw marks on these things. The only wounds on these horses where it looked like something thick and heavy just punctured the throats of these things and ripped down. He said it wasn't a claw, it wasn't teeth, it was a big stubby something, almost like big fat fingers, squeezed these horses' throats. Right next to the pond where these horses were killed, there was a dog pen. The neighborhood watchdog was in that pen. He said, nobody can come down this road unless that dog would go crazy. It was the watchdog of the entire neighborhood, and everybody knew it. There was nothing that would keep this dog from barking. He said, through this whole incident, this dog did not bark. While I was there, which was a week after, now keep this in mind, almost a week after the incident occurred, that dog did not come out of its house. It would sit in its house and look like a Disney character, you know, looking all scared and forlorn. He said it hasn't barked since the incident. And I keep in touch with one of the guys, and as far as I know, this dog still hasn't barked. And this is a couple years ago that I investigated this. So something, whatever was there, three horses, and scared this dog so bad, it will not bark. That was no animal that I know of other than Bigfoot, okay? He said, well, that's not the end of it. Let's go over here. So he took me to another man's house. He said, yeah, I'll show you what happened. We went down his hill, and there was where he kept his dog. He said, this dog was about 150 pounds. It was a big, happy dog, but it barked a lot if there was an intruder. If it ran towards you and put its feet up on your chest, it would knock you over. In the South, we have this thing where owners of dogs will put a chain between two trees. Then they will connect the dog's chain to that chain and then connect the chain to the collar. So this dog can run back and forth along this chain. Well, that's what this big dog was on. Something grabbed this dog by the back legs and kept backing up until that chain tightened up so tight that it popped that dog's head through the collar. Then it tossed the dog down a ravine. Again, no barking. These dogs were absolutely numb with fear, dealing with whatever was doing this. He showed me the collar, and it looked like you had shaved hair off of something's neck and attached it to the collar. The collar was so tight, it just shaved everything off of the dog's neck. He said, examining the dog, he found no blood except on one of the claws. And he said, I never saw a flesh break. I think the blood was from whatever was attacking this dog. And I said, where is everything? He said, well, it's all buried. You know, the dog is buried, the horses are buried. And I said, well, did the horses still have their tongues? And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, Bigfoot are known to yank the tongues out of livestock. And he said, well, I didn't think to look because I didn't know that was a thing, but I will tell you there was no blood on its mouth. The only blood that was on the horses' necks were in these big puncture holes that looked like big, giant, fat fingers just squeezed the necks. So I made my investigation. I was there for about 2 hours. And I said, well, beyond this, where are your water sources? And he said, well, you got the horse pond, and then about a quarter of a mile that way is another pond. And I could see the pond. And I said, well, are there any creeks? And he said, yeah, back behind us here. And I said, beyond this, have you ever heard anything strange in this area? And he said, yeah. We hear women screaming out there in the woods. And I said, well, that should tell you right there what we're dealing with. And he said, we can't get anybody to tell us what's going on. What do you think's going on? And I said, well, from my experience and my research, I think you're dealing with a Bigfoot, and I think it has something to do with the water. I think that it came through. This could be a big male. This could be a rogue new to the territory. But it was claiming that pond. It didn't want those horses there. That pond now belongs to it. And then they said, well, there's one other guy you need to talk to, but he probably won't talk to you. He had a calf killed just about a half a mile down, but he says he doesn't even want to deal with this. This is the craziest thing that he's ever seen, and he doesn't want to talk to anybody. And then the first guy, the guy that owned the horses, said, well, we're not done with the story yet. The government came in. And I said, well, what do you mean the government? He said, the Kentucky government came in here and tried to tell us this was nothing. And I said, well, tell me what's happened. He said, the Fish and Game Department came in here, three different guys in the same truck. So this was important. And they tried to tell us it was a cougar. And the guy said, I told him, you're crazy. You think this was a cougar. There are no claw marks. There are no foot tracks. And he said, no, it was a cougar. And they immediately jumped in the car and took off. Well, the next day, another government agency came in and said, well, these horses were shot. And the guy who owned the pond said, you're crazy. I sleep right there in the corner of that house. You're telling me that if three horses were shot, I wouldn't hear it? And he said, yeah, these horses were shot. And they jump in their car and take off. So whatever this was, it was important enough for the Kentucky government to come in there and try to tell them they weren't seeing what they were seeing. So that is just one of the many things I have investigated that will be in this book.
Lord have mercy. What a... That's the
yeah,
story.
There's
Robin? Robin, I wanted to ask you, do you have a question or comment for Dave?
No, I'm just enjoying listening to him. I really wanted to have been able to talk to him more when I was in Nebraska, and it was just so chaotic. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to. So this is really great because I've wanted to hear more of what he had to say.
Well, I got lots. I love to talk, and I'm looking forward to the event in October.
October 1st, Tennessee Bigfoot.
I just appreciate you having me on board, and I'll tell you some more stories. I'll tell you about getting lost in the pyramids of the Yucatan. How about that?
Oh, Lord, that sounds frightening. Well, I'll tell you what,
yeah,
Dave, this has been and Kyler, you asked a question earlier. Do you have a quick question for Dave or a comment?
No, I've kind of been doing the same as Robin, just listening, because that last story, that was pretty insane with everything that happened over there. That was cool.
That's like saying it was a frog. Doesn't matter what you saw, it was a frog.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
that's pretty classic in Bigfoot-related incidents. You know, people always, even if they didn't see what you're talking about, they always know exactly what it is, and they will tell you exactly what it is, and... You know, it's those armchair quarterbacks, you know, that they know it all, even though they never get out in the woods.
Right. Well, I tell you what, this has been just absolutely wonderful. We want to have you back here on ScaryCast here in a bit. It's been great. So wanted to say thank you so much for being with us. We've had a blast, and I'm sure our audience is going to have a blast too when they hear all this. So I want to say thank you very much for being with us. And Robin, thank you for introducing me to Dave so that we could get this show going. Thanks, Robin.
Yeah, Dave's a good guy. We had a good time. I said his wife was lovely. I only got to say hello to her at the dinner, and that was just for a millisecond. So I didn't get to spend a lot of time with either one of them. And I had hoped that I would, but it was just, there was a lot of people, a lot going on, and everybody was going different which ways.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much. Our Surgeon General, thank you very much for being here with those good questions and for your observations about the Charleston Museum.
Thanks, John. It was a great show tonight.
It really was. Devin Tate, thank you for being here from Sacramento. Let us know if you find anything there near the water and in the woods, okay?
I sure will. Thank you.
Yeah, I would love to hear if you have any success out there. So just keep us informed, man.
Yes, Robin?
I was asking David what state he lives in.
I'm in
California
Tennessee.
Still.
You're where?
Dave? So Dave's
in Tennessee,
right, Dave?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And Kyler Smith, thank you for being here from Houston, Texas. Glad to have you here.
Well, of course, no problem. I didn't really do much except listen, but thank you.
it is a lot of fun. That's
it
right.
Fun,
and
yeah.
So and we are going to definitely have you back again, Dave. We'll certainly be in touch, and it's been a lot of fun. So from all of the hosts of ScaryCast and from Dave Eller to everybody out there listening, please go out in the woods, but be careful and tell us what you have seen. It's amazing out here. I'm sitting in my car just because it's comfortable and the interesting shadows that I see out here, my goodness. So anyway, thanks a lot. We've had a great scary cast. We'll see everybody next week, same bat time, same bat channel, 9 p.m. Eastern time. The whole crew will be back. We hope everyone's still with us. And we'll talk to you later on the one, the only scary cast. Everybody can say goodbye.
Bye, David. It's nice to talk to you.
Good night.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Nice to meet you, Dave.
Good night.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.